There has been a legitimate cry nationwide for revelation, and determination of the facts and the truth. This is a logical and reasonable request, but obviously oversimplified. Some have even gone so far as to maintain that Thomas should be confirmed because otherwise it would set a precedent that might prevent any qualified person from seeking high appointee positions in government. Such reasoning, or lack thereof, shreds the Constitution and lets King George do it as per pre-Revolutionary War days. After carefully listening to both Thomas and Hill, this one member of the eventual jury of 100 feels both appear believable, but one seemingly is lying under oath, a criminal offense of perjury. Unfortunately, after the hearing, it is difficult, if not impossible, for me to determine what the facts or the truths are. I suspect that this might be the opinion of many who listened to the recently concluded hearings. Last week, during the hearings, I was disturbed about reported statements made by some of the Thomas supporters that if anyone testified against the nominee, that witness would in effect have their head served to them on a platter during the deliberations. Likewise, I was disturbed by some information reaching me that some Hill supporters felt that unless Thomas was rejected, it would be the equivalent of condoning sexual harassment of women. The president has said as recently as Sunday that the charges against the nominee are ridiculous and the process is ridiculous. This, Mr. President, from the man who from the beginning started the process with ridiculous statements that his nominee was selected strictly on the basis of the best qualified individual in all of America, and that the decision was devoid of any and all political or racial considerations. I clearly referenced my views of the president in this regard in my speech to the Senate on October 4th. Ridiculous statements in all of this began with the president. Is it any wonder that the nation is embroiled in this bitter controversy over ridiculous statements and conclusions magnified by the president's latest pronouncements from the golf course? You will forgive me if I employ my constitutional rights to criticize King George. Those whom I customarily turn to for advice on such important matters are deeply divided. My constituents, my family, my closest friends, and even my staff are unbelievably split. Emotions are running amok, and from every direction more so than I can recall previously from over 20 years of public service. The boat of discussion and decision-making has been so violently rocked that the rudder has been out of the water. So often it is difficult to steer any sound course to a sound determination. Both of the principals in this controversy have been hurt, and I feel deeply and personally for both. Judge Thomas was forthright in his denial, and that impressed me. Professor Hill was equally forthright in what I interpreted as a difficult disclosure on her part. If her detailed statements of alleged sexual harassment are accurate, it doesn't take just a woman to understand her anguish. Indeed, regardless of the eventual outcome of this matter, the controversy has clearly been beneficial in its significant contribution to the necessary changes and understandings in the workplace. Unfortunately, in my view, the hearings of the past 2 days have not produced any overall conclusive facts or definitive truths on the charges by Hill or the firm denials by Thomas. The key and central issue here, though, is not what is in the best interest of either of the two antagonists. We cannot not ignore what is fair or not fair to individuals, nor the harm to either that our eventual decision will bring. But even more important than that is how our decision will affect the future. To assail the process or attempt to punish individuals or institutions, which one might conclude in retrospect should have acted differently, evades and tends to place out of focus the real object of the process, as painful as it is for all. We must concentrate now on the all-encompassing issue as to whether or not Clarence Thomas should be confirmed for a lifetime appointment to the highest court in the land. On October 4th, I supported the nomination on the floor on the basis of my knowledge at that time. Among other things, I stated that I felt Judge Thomas met the test of judicial temperament. Notwithstanding my appreciation of the nominee's rage at the allegations, I was surprised and disappointed at many of his statements. They were not made in a fit of instantaneous anger, but rather well thought out and premeditated remarks. He said that he would rather have felt an assassin's bullet than go through the humiliating process, that he would rather die than withdraw his nomination, that the Senate had ruined his life and reputation, that the Senate hearing had been conducted in a manner equivalent to that of a lynch mob, that the process was ridiculous and like a circus. Those were phrases well orchestrated and employed by Thomas supporters. Such comments by the nominee, even under the circumstances, were at best overstatements. On the other hand, I have not been particularly impressed with the reasons advanced by Professor Hill as to how she could have brought herself to follow Judge Thomas so faithfully and so long in her career, given the sordid remarks allegedly made to her. I can understand her reluctance to make a formal complaint at the time, and her not telling any or all of the vast array of Thomas supporting witnesses who seemed to be saying in testimony that she should have confided in them. It was clear to me such would have likely been promptly reported to Thomas, which would not have been in her interest at that time. Yet I cannot readily understand why a person with her talents would not have conveniently found for herself a more satisfying position and superior quietly, if that were her wishes. But now, Mr. President, it's decision-making time, and we can't punt. In conclusion, let me say I have deliberated over this position and studied it for hours and hours and for days. There have been swings pro and con as I watched the hearings for solid conclusions that never materialized. Unlike some might believe, there has been no pressure on me from any source other than my determination to do what was best and right under the circumstances. There has developed in my mind no clear-cut choice, more of a mixture of concerns and doubts. How best do we conclude this whole unhappy chapter? Notwithstanding my reservations as to the nominee, I intend to vote for confirmation, but without enthusiasm. It is my hope that if confirmed, Judge Thomas will be a better justice because of this ordeal. It is my belief that he will not turn out to be the doctrinaire ideologue on the court that he is projected to be. We badly need some overall balance there. If confirmed, Judge Thomas has the roots and earlier experiences to provide that. Time will tell. Mr. President, I yield the floor.
Senator James Exon saying he will vote for confirmation, but without enthusiasm. Bob Franken, that's a theme we're likely to hear today. Exon was a key Democrat the White House was watching closely.
As a matter of fact, and he held his cards close to his vest, Frank, until the very end. Something that should be pointed out, Senator Exon is one of those who's very gregarious up here. He talks to everybody, and I witnessed him on many occasions talking to anybody in sight, including the tourists who would be around on the Capitol Plaza as he would walk back and forth. But probably the strongest influence he had came from his wife. He has related the story that as he was leaving his house when the first disclosures came out about the sexual harassment allegations, he was leaving for the plane. His wife said to him, "Come back here, Jim. I think you need to watch this." And they had a long conversation. Of course, I have no insight into how happy his wife is with his vote today, Frank.
Franken, thanks very much. And now taking the floor, Senator Alan Dixon of Illinois, also another Democrat believed to have been, or who said that he would support the nominee prior to the incidents. Let's listen.
That was leaked from the Judiciary Committee. Regrettably, prior to that time, no senators outside of the Judiciary Committee, with the possible exception of the majority and minority leaders, had been informed of the allegations. At that point, the Senate only had one real choice: to delay the vote on the nomination that had been scheduled for last Tuesday in order to provide an opportunity for a fuller investigation of the sexual harassment issue. I was among the first to call for such a delay. It would have been unconscionable, Mr. President, for the Senate to have voted without thoroughly reviewing such a serious matter. Last Friday, the Judiciary Committee began what became 3 long days of public hearings. For those 3 days, the nation became riveted on the testimony of Judge Thomas, Professor Hill, and the other witnesses, and transfixed on an issue: workplace sexual harassment. I condemn in the strongest way, as I have throughout my career, any type of sexual harassment. The last week has been a kind of national tragedy. But if the result is that the country becomes more sensitive to sexual harassment, then the dark clouds will have had a valuable silver lining. Today's vote is not a referendum on sexual harassment. If it were, I would hope and expect that the vote here in the Senate would be unanimous against it. Today's vote is also not a referendum on the nomination process. If it were, I think the vote would be unanimous that the process has swung out of control and that it reflects poorly on the Senate. What today's vote is about is whether Judge Clarence Thomas deserves appointment to the United States Supreme Court. Part of that calculation now involves the question of whether Judge Thomas sexually harassed Professor Anita Hill when they worked together at the Education Department and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The Judiciary Committee tried its best over the weekend to get to the truth of this matter. The unfortunate fact is, however, that Senate hearings are ill-suited to determine the true facts in situations like this one. Like most Americans, Mr. President, I spent a lot of time watching the hearings. I spent a lot of my career as a trial lawyer, and I've seen a lot of witnesses. What I saw last weekend was 2 convincing witnesses. Professor Hill's testimony was moving and credible. Judge Thomas's denial was forceful and equally credible. So what should the Senate do? Make no mistake, in the view of this senator at least, a charge of sexual harassment, if proven, disqualifies any nominee for a position on the United States Supreme Court. If Professor Hill had been credible and Judge Thomas had not, the Senate's decision would be simple. If Judge Thomas had been credible and Professor Hill had not, the Senate's choice would be equally clear. Since both were credible, however, and since it is impossible to get to the bottom of this matter, I think we have to fall back on our legal system and its presumption of innocence for those accused. Under our system, the burden falls on those making allegations. Under our system, the person being accused gets the benefit of the doubt. That isn't a legal loophole. It is a basic, essential right. A right of every American. If we're not to become a country where being charged is equivalent to being found guilty, we must preserve and we must protect that presumption. In this case, Mr. President, that means that Judge Thomas is entitled to a presumption of innocence. Since the Judiciary Committee hearings did not overcome that presumption, that means Professor Hill's allegations cannot be used to justify a vote against Judge Thomas. A decision on this nomination cannot be made on sexual harassment grounds. Instead, it must be made on the issues that have been before the Senate for the past 100 days and more. Mr. President, I will therefore cast my vote, as I had announced on October 1st, for the confirmation of Judge Clarence Thomas. I yield the floor.
And so Senator Alan Dixon becomes, by our count today anyway, the fifth Democrat to announce for the vote of Clarence Thomas. Bob Franken, comes as a surprise?
Not a surprise at all, but the significance of this is that Senator Dixon was one of the leading senators who had said, let's delay this for a week until we learn more.
And Senator Dixon was also one, or is one, who's up for election in 1992.
Actually, I'm not sure it is 1992. I will point out that he got 65% of the vote last time around. This could be a real wild card here.
Senator Alan Dixon, who just announced he will vote for Clarence Thomas, is indeed up for re-election in 1992. Let's listen to Biden.
We'll have the intellectual integrity to speak to the issue at hand. And that is, should Clarence Thomas be confirmed to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court? Many of us in the committee and out of the committee have already taken positions unrelated to, having nothing to do with, the subject, the specific subject of the hearings this past weekend, that, as one of our colleagues this morning said, riveted the attention of the American public. My view is that Clarence Thomas should not be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, because the views which Clarence Thomas has on matters of consequence that will shape the future of this nation are significantly different than ones that I hold, and I believe are significantly different than ones that have been espoused by the court for the past 40 years in the areas of separation of power, in the areas of the relative weight, the relative strength, the relative protection given to property and personal rights and privacy. I think that is the legitimate form within which we should debate whether or not a woman or man should become an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. Much of what happens, Mr. President, is totally beyond the control of the United States Senate to affect. Whether or not a right-wing group or a left-wing group, an interest group, runs ads that are not true on television or not, is something I have absolutely no impact on. I cannot affect. The Constitution prevents prevents the government from effecting. Whether or not a member of my committee or their staff engages in unethical conduct and releases a confidential memorandum addressed to me by a witness is something I cannot control, nor can the process control. The process can, as I announced, and as the majority leader reiterated, and as the ranking member indicated, can pursue within the rules who engage in unethical conduct, expose them, and reprimand them if we can find out. And I can say without any fear of contradiction, there is not a person in this body who has a stronger desire and a keener interest in unearthing the unethical individual or individuals than I do. But that is not the process's fault, Mr. President, any more than the process of the presidency does not function because we have had unethical presidents. Mr. President, so much is beyond the control of this body that understandably in the concern that has been evidenced by something that the public cannot, nor can I, fully fathom happening, having happened. The press is not a monolith. Pick up the paper today or last week or the week before, and you'll hear how horrible it was that the Senate Judiciary Committee proceeded under the rules in camera, in private, without public hearing. And the same people, some of the same people, writing a week later, expressing how horrible it is that the issue was debated under the rules in public. Some of my colleagues, one of whom I am particularly miffed by, I must tell you, and I will not mention, stated that he thought it was awful that the Senate Judiciary Committee did not share the FBI report with every senator. He's the same senator I recall saying that the Senate shouldn't get FBI reports. Human nature is rife with hypocrisy that can contain that conflagration. My friends in the press, God bless them all, so noble as they are, not a hypocritical one among them, the only human beings that do not have the same failings that the rest of us have. Understand, let me put it this way, Mr. President. We are now debating in America the televising of trials. Nothing to do with the Senate now. Televising of trials that take place in state and federal court systems. And there is a cry. The public has a right to know. And they do. And there's a strong constitutional argument that would suggest that if press is allowed in to transcribe, why should not press be allowed in to televise? But mark my words, Mr. President. The first time there is a trial about sexual abuse or rape or harassment, where as an element of the crime, the victim is required under the law to explicitly and in detail state what happened. And the television camera broadcast that across the public medium. Television. There will be a hue and cry. Because this is a phenomenon we have yet to encounter and resolve as a nation. It's no one's fault, Mr. President. It's the nature of technology and our fundamental commitment to our Anglo-American notion of jurisprudence, which says that people in criminal cases are innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and in almost all civil cases, the accused, the defendant, is given the benefit of the doubt. That runs head-on against the notion of fairness in the context of Klieg lights. Because it is a truism. Any woman or man accused of a crime, televised as opposed to it being held in camera, in a state court or in a Senate hearing room where there was no accusation of a crime but of wrongdoing, even if the person is totally exonerated, their reputation will have been damaged, because 1%, 2%, 5%, 7%, 10%, 40% of the public will say, well, why would they have been accused if they didn't do it? We all know in our criminal system, the mere bringing of an indictment is an indictment, even though you and I know that it means nothing under our system of laws. It has nothing to do with whether or not a man or a woman is innocent or guilty under our system. They are innocent, notwithstanding the indictment, until they are proven guilty. All the indictment says is, you must come to court and be tried. But the mere issuing of an indictment in a criminal proceeding unrelated to the Senate can ruin a woman or a man's reputation, even when they are exonerated by a jury who unanimously says, no, they did not kill Cock Robin. And I think that's part of the moral dilemma we're all wrestling with here. No one liked what happened. No matter who is at fault, assume for the sake of discussion that the witness was lying completely. No one still would have liked the proceeding. Assume for the moment that the nominee was lying completely. No one could have enjoyed what has taken place. And the same criticisms would pertain. Mr. President, we have a serious task. And the task is to decide by this one vote that we will cast today, not whether or not Clarence Thomas engaged in sexual harassment or any conduct unbefitting to a justice, not whether or not Anita Hill was victimized in any way, but whether or not, taking all things into consideration, from the charge to philosophy to judicial temperament, everything into consideration, we as an institution, exercising our constitutional responsibility, believe that this man should sit on the court God willing, his health prevailing, longer than I suspect any of us are likely to remain in the Senate. This is a vote about the future of America, not just about Clarence Thomas's reputation. Oh, there is no doubt that if Clarence Thomas, I mean, the worst of all positions for a woman or man to be in this body would be the following, in my view. Convinced that Clarence Thomas was the wrong man for the court because of his ideas and because of the direction he would take America, but also convinced that Clarence Thomas was totally innocent of any wrongdoing in the matter relating to sexual harassment. That is a moral dilemma. Because then, one knows if they cast their vote based on their conscience that this man should not, from their perspective, based on his ideas, sit on the Supreme Court. They know it will be read as he was not believed with regard to harassment. They know it will affect his reputation. If Clarence Thomas were to lose today with 51 votes to 49 votes, the history books would say the reason he lost was because of this. Conversely, if Clarence Thomas wins, the history books will say, I suspect, that Anita Hill was not credible, or was less credible. Mr. President, we are voting the future of the nation, not the character of the man. If the character impacts upon the ability of that person to perform his duties, which sexual harassment, in my view, would if you were convinced it occurred, so be it. I have, as we all have had, everyone, in the Senate, out of the Senate, in the press, in politics, in any discipline, we've all had challenging things to do in our life and challenging things we've been confronted with. And I still am not sure precisely how I am to perform today my responsibilities. On the one hand, as chairman of the committee, I felt it my absolute obligation to be as fair as was humanly possible and have rulings and questions and statements consistent with that fairness. I did not run for the United States Senate to become a judge. There's only three things I knew I didn't want to be. One was a judge, the other was a police officer, and the third was a mayor. Because they're all incredibly difficult jobs that I don't feel myself personally suited for, based on how I think. I became a defense attorney instead of a prosecutor because that's where I find more comfort. I am not accusatory by nature. But the job is to try to see to it that justice is done within my limited capabilities as chairman. But all the while, everybody knows, prior to any of this occurring, I was against the nomination of Clarence Thomas, based on philosophy. And today, and I will cease now for the moment, today, I will essentially, till toward the end of this process, conduct myself in the former capacity, as best I can, see to it that everybody has an opportunity to speak, because we're all grown people in this body. All the women and men in this body had a chance now to see essentially what all of us saw. They don't need me to tell them. They don't need me to inform them. They don't need me to convince them. Their judgment about the veracity of the witnesses is equally as sound as mine. And so I will speak later, much later, about the process. I will speak later today about the nomination. But in the meantime, I will perform my responsibilities as, if you will, the traffic police officer in this operation, performing a second duty I didn't want to perform as a police officer, and essentially allocating the time on my side. I thank the chair for their indulgence, and I yield the floor.
Wheels time.
Mr. President.
Chair recognizes the senator from Iowa. Does the senator from South Carolina yield time?
I yield. 20 minutes, Dane, senator from Iowa.
Okay.
Senator from Iowa is recognized.
Mr. President, I would ask that you would notify, Mr. President, I would ask that you notify me when 18 minutes have passed. Mr. President, when I embarked on a... Okay. Mr. President, I embarked on a career of public service 33 years ago. I think I was then and still am motivated by a desire to be involved in public policy, to strengthen the people of Iowa and their quality of life, as well as to help make their great nation, this great nation, an even better place to live, work, and to raise our families. Now, never, Mr. President, could I have imagined that I would sit through a spectacle such as the one that we conducted in the Judiciary Committee this weekend. If it hadn't been for the fairness of the chairman, it probably would have even been more of a spectacle. This ordeal was for me and my colleagues, as well as the participants, one of gargantuan proportions. I was troubled, disturbed, and pained going into the hearing, and I was even confused at times during the hearing. But now, after it's all over, I've had the chance to observe and to question witnesses and to consider their testimony. So now I would like to deal with some of the allegations brought against Clarence Thomas and his fitness to serve on the Supreme Court. Now, at the outset, Mr. President, the entire Judiciary Committee operated from the premise that fairness required Professor Anita Hill to prove her allegations. As you know, she accused Judge Thomas of sexual harassment, and she had to establish the truthfulness of these charges. Judge Thomas stands accused, but he need not prove his innocence. And to the extent that any of my colleagues find the situation continues to be cloudy and murky and unclear, Judge Thomas must be given the benefit of the doubt. It is fundamental to our system that any doubts be resolved in favor of the accused. Now, Chairman Biden noted this at the beginning of the hearing, and he repeated it many times during the hearing. He said it, that Judge Thomas was entitled to be given the benefit of the doubt. That, Mr. President, was the committee's starting point. Now, we must take note that this extraordinary hearing resulted from a breakdown in the confirmation process, a leak to the press of confidential FBI reports. Had this report not become public, the Senate could have handled the matter in confidence. The leak caused irreparable harm to these two individuals, Judge Thomas, Anita Hill. The leak was irresponsible. It was in violation of the Senate rules and possibly illegal. It was an insult to the many committee members who approach the confirmation process fairly and carefully. And I find it particularly ironic that in the process designed to find a ninth person to protect the rule of law in this nation, a ninth person on the Supreme Court, so much disregard for both rule and law was demonstrated. The leak should be investigated, and those responsible for it should be punished. As a result of this leak, the Judiciary Committee was asked to hold hearings to determine whether these allegations had any factual validity. The Senate Judiciary Committee is quite able to investigate legislative facts, information about societal problems, and legislation proposed to address them. However, this committee is ill-suited to conduct a trial. Trials are why the judicial branch was created. The American people need to understand that we on the committee cannot make a conclusive determination as to whether or not Professor Hill's allegations are true. Professor Hill had recourse for deciding whether these allegations were meritorious because sex harassment is a serious charge and there are remedies for it. This charge is offensive, intolerable conduct which requires immediate corrective action. Under Title VII, the federal employee has 30 days in which to file a charge of sexual discrimination, including sexual harassment. I should say employment discrimination, including sexual harassment. If Professor Hills wasn't satisfied with the administration determination, she could have sued in federal court. But make no mistake, Professor Hill had a place to go 10 years ago when this harassment that she asserts to took place. So what in fact did happen? We will probably never know all the facts. But this was high drama from the perspective of this senator from the state of Iowa. This at times resembled a soap opera about the elite and aspiring power brokers here in Washington, D.C. There was plenty of talk about Yale Law School, establishment law firms, and moving up the political ladder. But as I considered all of the testimony, much of it extremely offensive and difficult for me to endure, I have to conclude that in spite of her sincerity, and in spite of her competence, and in spite of apparent credibility, Professor Hill's story just does not add up. Let me explain the reasons for this conclusion. Professor Hill's testimony was filled with inconsistencies. Frankly, I was left with more questions after the hearing than before. For example, why did she follow Judge Thomas from the Department of Education to the EEOC if he had harassed her in the horrible, offensive fashion that she claims? And why didn't she even explore her options for remaining as a lawyer at the Department of Education? After all, she was a civil service employee, not a political hire. And why did she make at least 11 phone calls to Judge Thomas between 1983 and 1987 after she left Washington, D.C.? Why did she want to, in her very own words, keep up a cordial and professional relationship with a man who she said tormented her? And then there's the substance of the allegations. As I saw it, Professor Hill had three different stories about the harassment she suffered. First, there was the harassment that she told her friends at the time that it occurred. To these individuals, Judge Susan Hirshner of California, Ellen Wells, and John Carr, she described only a general claim of sexual harassment by her boss. There were no details and no specifics. Second time that we heard it was when Professor Hill told Senate staffers when she requested confidentiality and to the FBI when she decided that she wanted the Senate, but still not the entire public, to know about her charge. To them, she said Judge Thomas repeatedly asked her for dates and talked about pornographic movies, but not himself. And the third version of the harassment was the lurid, the graphic, and what I consider the offensive story she told on Friday during her testimony. There can be little doubt, Mr. President, that Professor Hill magnified the allegations for her live testimony on TV. But one of the most puzzling chapters in this saga was the role that her friends played. Three people testifying before her, claiming to be close friends, and one asserting a close professional relationship, were told by Professor Hill of the ordeal that she experienced. But Mr. President, we heard none of the graphic details from them on Sunday that she told us on Friday. These people had no specifics from Professor Hill. They had no firsthand knowledge of Professor Hill's claims. And even more significantly, they offered no advice to their friend, Anita Hill. They said they tried to listen and they tried to comfort her. But Mr. President, these were four highly intelligent, well-educated lawyers like Professor Hill herself. And they could think of nothing to say to her to help her remedy this horrible situation. Now, what does it say about our system if four lawyers could not recommend that she pursue legal remedies against her harasser? I was particularly struck by Professor Paul, whom Professor Hill told in 1987 that she left the EEOC because she was sexually harassed by a supervisor. Professor Paul went out of his way to tell us he was not opposed to Senator Clarence Thomas or Clarence Thomas's nomination. He repeatedly said he didn't sign an anti-Thomas petition a few months ago. But if he knew Anita Hill to be a victim of harassment by Judge Thomas, then why didn't he see this as a disqualifying factor? The reason has to be that he did not connect Judge Thomas to Anita Hill's predicament. Professor Hill never mentioned Clarence Thomas's name to Professor Paul. Once again, a non-specific charge with no supporting facts, not even Judge Thomas's name to back it up. These were not, Mr. President, corroborating witnesses. They were collaborating witnesses, collaborating with the special interest groups that pounced on Anita Hill and her story in their effort to assassinate the character and the integrity of Judge Clarence Thomas. And lastly, although there are many more inconsistencies in this sordid affair, is the matter of what she was told by Senate staff. Mr. President, Anita Hill believed there was a distinct possibility that Judge Thomas would withdraw from this confirmation process if she came forward to the committee with her allegations. I don't know why she wants to keep Judge Thomas off the course, off of the court. Ideological differences on issues from affirmative action to abortion and a Washington career that didn't go quite according to her plan are among some of the possibilities. But one thing is very clear. She thought by coming forward in confidence before the committee that she could make a difference and derail this nomination. We have some overzealous Senate staff to thank for planting that seed in her mind. Contrast those inconsistencies and often questions with the unshakable testimony that we had from Judge Clarence Thomas and his former colleagues and friends. He categorically denied that each of these charges He never wavered from this denial, never made inconsistent statements. Have 18 minutes passed.
The senator asked to be reminded when 18 minutes had elapsed. 18 minutes have elapsed at this time.
Mr. President, in my last 2 minutes, I asked that the rest of my statement be put in the record, and I have one final thought that I would like to make.
Without objection, the senator's entire statement will be included in the record as requested.
Mr. President, I said I never expected in my years upon entering politics to go through the spectacle we just went through. It now, I hope, brings Judge Thomas to be confirmed. I hope that we never have to go through an ordeal like this again. It has not been the Senate's finest hour, although I do believe the Judiciary Committee under Senator Biden's fine leadership did a fair and thorough job, given the constraints and limitations inherent in the committee's work. In January, Mr. President, we participated in the most serious and weighty matter that we're charged with, and that was on the question of taking our country to war. This weekend, we discussed things on television that I'm uncomfortable discussing behind closed doors. That is a far distance to travel in less than a year. It has been asserted that this, too, was part of a democratic system. But I hope that there is a way to restore ourselves and the American people the ideals of representative democracy, ideals that brought down the Berlin Wall, that inspired the student revolt in Tiananmen Square, and that sustained Boris Yeltsin in his standoff with the coup plotters. I believe that we can do it, but we must do it, and I urge my colleagues to confirm Judge Thomas as one step in that direction.
Colonel North, thank you for joining us. In 1985 and 86, you were deeply involved in what has come to be known as the Iran-Contra affair. In 1987, you appeared before those now well-remembered congressional hearings looking into it, and in 1989, you were convicted on 3 counts arising from this, counts that have been laid aside now. In the book, you say probably the most telling line, or the line that stands out, is that now more than ever you're convinced that Ronald Reagan knew everything. What convinces you of that?
Well, Charles, it's a totality of things that I knew before and things that I learned afterwards that have taken me right up through the present time that led me to that conclusion. In fact, it's no different than what I had concluded in the hearings. I said in 1987 that I believed then that the president had not only known but approved of what I was doing. I have concluded since then, based on things that he himself has said, things that happened after I was dismissed from the White House, that he did indeed know all of what was going on and indeed approved it.
I don't recall Ronald Reagan ever saying much of anything about knowing all that was going on.
No, I base it on the totality of all that happened. The missives that I received shortly after I was dismissed from the White House, the emissaries that were sent to tell me to simply clear the president, the tape that Ted Koppel played on the other network that's listed in my book, those things indicate to me that the president did indeed know and approve of what I was doing.
The tape that you refer to came into your and your lawyer's hands during the course of the investigation. It's 2 unidentified voices on a crossed phone line. One of those voices is saying that there is a smoking gun in the closet. Reagan knows and has all the memos, I think was the later line in there. But you haven't identified that man. No one has been identified as being the voice on that tape. How do you even know that that tape might not be a hoax?
I don't know that the tape is not a hoax. I don't know that Citibank, when it acquired it, didn't simply catch 2 people playing some kind of a joke. The fact of the matter is it came into our hands as a part of the investigation from the prosecutor. They chose not to pursue that, apparently. Arthur Lyman, who was the chief counsel to the Senate committee that investigated Iran-Contra, indicated that he'd never been given access to the tape. I find that to be somewhat strange. I don't necessarily ascribe to the grand conspiracy theory of Washington, but I find it to be strange that the special prosecutor never made an effort to to give it to the committee to have them investigate it.
Well, it's a pretty thin piece of evidence then.
Well, what I have indicated to Charles is the totality of all that happened to me. And just a word on that. What has happened is that you and your colleagues have chosen to focus on one line out of a 446-page book. I believe that there's a broader story there, and that broader story is that Ronald Reagan's presidency laid the foundation for the success that the United States has enjoyed, the collapse of communism. Margaret Thatcher, just a few weeks after I finished the book and while it was being printed, was here and said of Ronald Reagan, he won the Cold War without firing a shot. And indeed, that's what happened. The success that the Bush administration has enjoyed in its foreign policy had its foundation in the 8 years of Ronald Reagan's presidency.
For all this praise of Ronald Reagan that we're hearing, I have a sense that Ronald Reagan let you down. You refer to another line in the book and a quote that we've heard, where the president called you after the affair became exposed and said, "You have to understand, I just didn't know." Did you say to him at that point, obviously you didn't, but you did know, Mr. President?
No, I didn't. In fact, what I said to the president at that point is that I was deeply sorry that this was going to affect his presidency, that was certainly the furthest from what Admiral Poindexter and I would ever have intended, and I was sincere in that. It wasn't until much later that I began to wonder exactly what those words meant. And I know well that President Reagan relied heavily on his staff. I think it was that staff that went out to savage me after I was dismissed.
Who specifically?
I don't know.
Reagan?
I think it was some of his people. Whether he himself personally directed it, I don't know. But after I was dismissed, a number of my former colleagues came to me and indicated what Mr. Reagan's staffers as to how they were to handle North.
I still sense that you felt left down by Ronald Reagan. Is this in any way getting even with this book?
Yeah,
you're getting your shot back?
Yeah, this is not an attack book. I'd be very, very straightforward about it, Charles. I do feel disappointed. I had enormous admiration for Ronald Reagan. I still do. Without any false sense of hubris, I would have died for Ronald Reagan. I just wasn't willing to go to jail for him. I saw Ronald Reagan as a man who literally changed the world during the 5.5 years that I worked at the White House. I saw 11 new democracies in the world. I saw an immensely popular president who could capitalize on that popularity in the international arena, and yet was unable or unwilling to make that same investment here domestically. The American people overwhelmingly approved of what he was doing and how he did it. And yet, given the chance to recapture some of the proper presidential prerogatives from an imperial Congress, he didn't do that. His domestic advisors were far less willing to take the risks necessary than were his foreign policy advisors.
Let me ask you about some of the other allegations that you make in the book about people coming to you and say, basically, exonerate the president. Whatever you do, don't testify against him. There are people who are saying, people who are named in the book, Ross Perot among them, who are saying, you're lying again. Ed Meese has suggested much the same thing, I believe, former Senator Paul Laxalt. There are folks who are saying, you lied to Congress. Why believe this man now?
Well, I would point out, first of all, that those are the same people in many respects who accused me of lying earlier. You have to remember, back in November and December of 1986, when I was dismissed, I was the wild man, the loose cannon on the gun deck of state, the renegade who was running these operations totally independently out of the White House.
The cowboy in the basement.
The cowboy in the basement. Only third floor basement in all of Washington. Those were the stories that were put out to destroy my credibility so that if I said something about the president, it would be dismissed as, even as recently as this month, we've had people now plead guilty to having withheld or falsely stated what they knew about what I did. It's, I think, fairly clear to everyone, your colleagues, the Congress, the special prosecutor, that what I said in 1987, the first chance I had a chance to answer the questions, was indeed true. That this was an operation that was approved at the highest levels of the land, that the Congress of the United States had left loopholes through which we worked, and that what I had done had been fully approved.
But more than loopholes, Colonel, I mean, you yourself were convicted of obstructing Congress. That's one of the counts on which you were convicted.
Well, as let's deal specifically with it. I was convicted of aiding and abetting another's obstruction of Congress, and that charge was dismissed along with all of them on the 16th of September this year.
The charge was dismissed primarily because of a legal technicality.
Well, let's
Would you not say?
No, I would say because...
You weren't found innocent.
One in our system, Charles, one is not found innocent. The best you could ever hope to be is declared not guilty, and that's not declared innocent. The fact of the matter is that it was determined that the indictment which was brought against me should never have been brought. That's the outcome. It's not a technicality. The Fifth Amendment protections, the fifth of those Bill of Rights that we'll celebrate this December, is no less important than the First Amendment that you guard so zealously. And with good reason, we ought to, all 10 of those are immensely important to this nation, to the people of this country. It's what makes us different from all the rest of the world that tries to emulate what we have.
We need to take a break, Colonel. When we return, I want to ask you a little bit about George Bush and his role. Stay with us, please. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, talking about the Reagan-Bush administration, President Bush, then Vice President, gets almost negligible notice in your book. People find it hard to believe that a man who had run the CIA, who was actively, presumably, and you accompanied him down to Latin America, actively in pursuit of aid for the Contras, knew so little about this. How much contact did you have with then Vice President Bush? How much were you keeping him apprised of your activity?
Charles, one thing that people ought to understand is that Vice President Bush was not in my chain of command as a military officer or as NSC staff officers. We all reported...
This was not a normal chain of command operation, though, was it?
Oh, I think very much so. The National Security Advisor was my reporting senior, and the President of the United States was his reporting senior. We went through a number of National Security Advisors during that period of time, but the chain of command didn't change. I did accompany then Vice President Bush on one trip in which he, contrary to the wimp image that many tried to create for him, he went into a room full of armed men and told them that democracy had to prevail in El Salvador. That meeting with President Magana and the leadership of the Salvadoran military had nothing to do with the Nicaraguan resistance.
It sounds like a man who would have been a strong ally for what you were engaged in.
Well, I think that Vice President Bush was a very strong ally for the foreign policy.
No, but I'm talking
about the
Reagan administration. The Iran-Contra connection.
Well, let me talk about the Iran-Contra connection, because that diversion, I think, is what has created a distraction from the real issues. The administration, as we have now seen with a five-year inquisition by Prosecutor Walsh, was deeply involved in the support for the Nicaraguan resistance. No one has been tried for diverting money from the Ayatollah to the aid of the Nicaraguan resistance. What people have been tried for is lying about what they knew about what I was doing. I've laid that out in Under Fire, the book that I wrote. I didn't put George Bush into the middle of those activities because he wasn't in the middle of those activities. Then Vice President Bush was a member of the National Security Council, sat in those councils that weighed in on those foreign policy decisions. But when I, as a National Security Staff Officer, went to El Salvador on a specific mission to support the resistance, to set up an air base to support resupply operations for the resistance, I did so at the direction of Bud McFarlane or Admiral Poindexter, not at the direction of Vice President Bush.
Do you judge Mr. Bush as a man who's quite comfortable with covert action?
I would have to defer to what he would say about it. Obviously, as the director of Central Intelligence, he had experience with that, yes.
Do you think he might have bent the rules?
bent the rules. I have no evidence to support that contention whatsoever. The rules that are established for handling of covert operations have just been subject to probably the closest scrutiny that this nation has ever gone through in the hearings for Mr. Gates. I don't think that there's anyone who's made that allegation or at least supported it.
What about Mr. Gates? He was the deputy director of Central Intelligence at the time all of this was happening under Bill Casey. There seems to be a difference, at least in terms of what you are saying about Mr. Gates and what he is saying, insofar as what he knew was going on with the Iran-Contra diversion.
Well, I'm not familiar with what he is saying or isn't saying, Charles.
I believe his assertions are that you told him that the CIA was clear of involvement, and I believe your assertion is you told him that it just wouldn't show up, not those precise words.
Well, I'd have to look at what he said and his description of those words. Let me just clarify one thing that you did say. He was not the deputy director of Central Intelligence during the entire time of this. In fact, for a very brief time, he was the deputy director during my tenure at the White House. For most of that time prior, he was the director of intelligence. I did meet with him on a number of occasions. I had lunch with him, I believe, on one occasion. He did join a lunch that Director Casey and I had shortly after the airplane in which Eugene Hassenfuss was a crewman was shot down over Nicaragua. And I did assure Director Casey that the CIA's involvement in this operation would not be revealed. I was, of course, wrong. It turns out that there were records on the airplane. There was the statements of the statement of Mr. Hassenfuss that he was involved with the CIA. He, in fact, was not, but that transpired to open up the CIA's and the U.S. government's involvement in El Salvador with support for the resistance. Mr. Gates's awareness of that would be something that the internal workings of the CIA would show. It wouldn't come from me because I didn't deal with him on it.
How do you feel as a private citizen now about Bob Gates, a man whose role is still somewhat questionable, or at least not been clarified to everyone's satisfaction here in Washington, becoming the director of Central Intelligence at this time when the CIA itself may need a new direction?
Yeah. I guess I've learned a lot about everyone's satisfaction in Washington over the last 5 years. If I didn't know it when I got to Washington in 1981, I've certainly learned it since. And I'm not sure that anyone could ever do anything to everyone's satisfaction in Washington. I would suppose, as a private citizen, that Bob Gates is as qualified as any other nominee might be put up. I have confidence that his experience will be important at a point in time when our intelligence efforts are going to be critical to knowing what's going on in a very rapidly changing world.
Not tainted?
Tainted in what way, Charles?
Well, I don't know. I'm asking you.
Not in my opinion.
You say in the book that there are still things that you don't know about Iran-Contra. What?
Well, I don't know the exact role of certain of the intermediaries that we dealt with. I don't know the exact role of certain of the people that were involved with the hostage recovery effort. God willing, those hostages that are still there will, like Jesse Turner, come home soon to join their families. And there can be a more fulsome exposition on that issue.
Even after Mr. Turner's release this week, there are still four Americans, I believe, who are still held hostage. Do you think that the events back in 85, 86 contributed to the fact that they remain hostage today?
One of the great issues I've had to wrestle with is having participated in a process that established the price for an American life. That, to me, is the most difficult part of all that I did. In retrospect, I should have struggled harder against that whole idea. I became involved with that in November of 1985. I had written much of the original policy opposing that kind of an idea. The policy statements that I had helped craft that the president articulated was that we would not make concessions to terrorists. Regardless, do you think you did?
Regardless of what we think we did, the effect is that people perceive we did, and that's as important as whether or not we did.
But in your opinion, did you in any way make concessions?
Well, I can certainly understand how the president, President Reagan, can still say in his memoirs, as he did, we didn't deal directly with the hostage holders, and we didn't. The fact of the matter is that the world perceives that this was arms for hostages, and that, particularly at a time when we were saying to the rest of the world, you cannot deal with the Iranian government, was wrong, and I say that in under fire.
What do we need to do? Colonel North, let me ask you about this book. Some close to, I guess, 500,000 copies will be hitting the newsstands or the bookshelves this week. You're going to make a lot of money on this book. You had a lot of big debts, legal debts for the most part. Are those all paid?
They're not all paid yet, Charles. I must tell you that the American people's generosity and prayers have been an important part of sustaining my family during the last 5 years. And it has paid the lion's share of them. I still have obligations that I've incurred as a consequence of this. Lord willing, this book will help us get back on our feet and help to rebuild our lives.
How about that security fence? Was that ever fully paid for?
The security fence is still there. We have, just for the record, Charles, my son and I built that fence that your colleagues hung over for 7 months. It was not part of what came to be called the security system that I was charged with accepting. We have since moved from that house. My hope that is that the new occupants have not been surrounded as we were once there while your colleagues are looking for us.
How do you feel about allegations, accusations even, that for 5 years you wouldn't tell your story, but now you're selling it?
Well, I told my story as in answers to the incredible number of questions that were posed to me both in the hearings and in my trial and in the various tribunals that I was compelled to appear before, to include the trial of Admiral Poindexter, one of the greater travesties in Washington. In each case, I was allowed to answer the question that was posed. This book is my effort to tell the story behind the headlines. Everybody wanted to know the very question you started this interview with. That is, what did the president know? What did you do, and when did you tell him about it? The fact of the matter is, this is why I did what I did and how I did it. The motivations that drove me, not all of them pristine. There's straightforward admissions of my faults in this book. And my hope is that Under Fire will be an inspiration to some other people, not to avoid government, but to do the right thing while they're in government.
You're 48 years old now. When the book tour is over and the book sales start to taper off, what do you do then?
Well, I have started a business. I make ballistic protective equipment for law enforcement. We have about 55 contracts around America with law enforcement departments and agencies. We have some federal contracts.
But do you see yourself as a businessman the rest of your life?
Well, I have been a believer in the free enterprise system for some time. I've been blessed to go out and speak to major corporations about overcoming adversity and difficult times. I've now started a corporation of my own. I found it to be an exciting opportunity.
Well, I know this isn't an original question, but a lot of people think you might get into politics, or have you seen enough of politicians?
I think I'd have a hard time referring to Senator Kennedy as dear colleague. I have been asked to run. I have been blessed to be able to go out and help others. For right now, I think that's enough. I'm running hard for husband and father.
Let me ask you just one last question, a few seconds left. Could this happen again? Has the nation been put on any kind of alert?
It's not so much a matter of whether it could happen again. It's a matter of whether or not the Congress and the executive can learn to work in a system that was designed to have a balance of power, not a...